It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Governor Tony Evers lays out his policy goals for the year ahead, we get analysis on last night's annual State of the State address delivered in the State Assembly chambers, and you can join the discussion. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anya Van Wagtendonk is WPR State Capitol Reporter. Anya, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate.
Hi, and Sean Johnson here as well, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Kate.
So, Sean, starting with you, Democratic governor addressing the Republican-led legislature, non-budget year, what was the tenor like in the assembly chambers last night?
You know, in the chambers itself, if you watch these things, you're kind of used to how it goes in terms of which side claps for what. There are 64 Republicans in the 99-member assembly, and they tend to sit for a lot of what the governor says. The Democrats tend to stand up and clap for a lot of it. So that's sort of the tenor in the room. I think if you look at his speech, it was, a little feisty in terms of the content. He was talking about bills he would veto on restrictions to abortion, for example, restrictions to voting. He kind of made reference at one point to his gubernatorial opponent in 2022,
Tim Michaels,
saying, hey, you don't see him up here right now talking about the issue of abortion, where he and Tim Michaels were, kind of polar opposite. So I think it was a speech that it was sort of fitting for an election year, even though he's not, personally on the ballot.
And Anya, typical in these gatherings, as Sean said, much applause from Democratic lawmakers. What stood out to you about the sentiment in the chambers and the style of the address?
Yeah, it was a kind of lighthearted tenor, I think. It felt a little bit like sort of back to school after winter break or something. And so I think the Democrats were feeling a little bit fired up about some themes of the speech, especially around sort of women's healthcare and reproductive access. They are not typically, generally when I'm covering the assembly, it is a space where Democrats have no particular power. And so I think this is kind of a night that they get to stand behind, their guy, cheer for some of their messaging, even though, when it comes to legislating, they might not actually get to achieve a whole lot of their goals.
So, Anya, last night, the governor declares 2024 the year of the worker, announcing new programs, initiatives to address the workforce shortages in the state. Can you talk about what he said in these programs?
Yeah, well, so he tied, many different issues to the workforce shortage, so mm-hmm. healthcare, housing, and childcare, but he also announced some sort of specific government programs that he argues are going to, bring people into the workforce and keep them there. So he announced a healthcare workforce task force, which would develop recommendations about sort of building out that particular sector, a teacher apprenticeship program through the Department of Workforce Development and DPI that's supposed to focus on teacher retention and mentorship for new teachers. And he also said that he'll establish an Office of State Employee Engagement and Retention, which is what it sounds like. It's focused on keeping state employees in the public sector.
And in talking about these challenges facing our state's workforce, told lawmakers providing additional state funding for affordable housing. And let's hear an excerpt.
Since I took office, we've invested in building nearly 15,000 affordable housing units, nearly 2,500 last year alone, and more than 24,000 housing units total. And we're not stopping there. This past year, we worked together to invest more than $500 million in workforce housing.
So, Sean, they're taking stock by the numbers. What do you hear in that in providing support for affordable housing in the state?
I think that was one of the big issues where in 2023, Governor Tony Evers and Republicans had this list of big bipartisan deals that you didn't really see as much in his first term. And then for whatever reason, the circumstances were right. Last year, they cut a bunch of big agreements, and housing was one of them. The $500 million in the budget to pay for this housing package that he signed, that Republicans passed, was a significant amount of money. And you had in that package of bills establishing loan programs for builders and landlords, making it easier for developers to get permits for new residences, putting limits on who can challenge permitting decisions, requiring that local governments approve permits for residential housing projects that don't violate local standards. But the money is a big deal when it comes to Evers and Republicans. They don't always see eye to eye on that stuff, and this was a big one where they did.
We're talking about Governor Evers' State of the State address last night. Sean Johnson is here, Anya Van Wagtendonk, both reporters covering the state capitol and politics for WPR. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Anya, one clear connection that the governor made was to workforce was childcare, saying that our state it has a looming childcare crisis and highlighting directing $170 million in the childcare counts, funding the program, aiding childcare providers.
Without continued investments in childcare counts, our workforce will suffer mightily. 2,110 childcare programs are projected to close. 87,000 kids could be without child care. We could lose over 4,880 child care jobs. That's about $500 million of economic impact on our state.
Okay, so he makes the case there. What are Republicans saying about this program or broader child care needs?
Yeah, this is a really big fight sort of all of last year. Child care counts as a COVID-era federal subsidy program. And so as it was due to expire, child care advocates were at the Capitol kind of all the time pushing for more funds. Evers had included that funding in his budget, and then legislative Republicans nixed it. Then Evers ordered a special legislative session to take that up and other child care issues in September. Republicans also did not take that up. And so that's been this sort of back and forth all of 2023. Many Republicans do agree that there is a child care shortage, but they really differ with Democrats on how to address the issue. So some don't think, for example, that there should be kind of that provider level subsidy type program. So Republicans instead introduced their own legislation on this issue. They proposed things like tax incentives and tax cuts that they say will help put more money into families' pockets, so that families can sort of make their own childcare decisions. And then also on the sort of more provider side of things, they've proposed things like deregulation to address childcare staff shortages. So it really is this kind of philosophical difference about how to address the same problem.
Turning to the topic of reproductive health, Governor Evers announced directing the state health department to issue a standing order for Badger Care Plus to cover over-the-counter contraception, including emergency contraception. Anya, what is known so far about this new directive?
Yeah, it's an interesting directive. So right now, low-income people who qualify for the state Medicaid program, they can get emergency contraception covered and they can get prescription birth control covered. They don't pay for those medications under Badger Care. But then last summer, the FDA approved a new birth control pill that will be available over the counter. So you can walk into a drugstore and purchase it without a prescription, like Advil or whatever. And so what this does is it allows the pharmacy to process the insurance of a Badger Care Plus holder to pay for that over-the-counter drug. So in short, they can purchase those pills for free. And I'm curious, we got this announcement about 12 hours ago, so I haven't gotten to make phone calls on it, but I'm curious if this exists in other states. It seems like a really interesting proposal to me that I'm not familiar with elsewhere.
Yeah, Sean, what comes up for you in this proposal, in this directive?
I guess the immediate thought was, but that sounds interesting, but is that the norm in other states, or is the governor, taking liberties here, or could it be argued he is? When there are disputes in our state government, they often involve Republicans saying that an agency under Evers' control is doing stuff that should have been approved by the legislature first. Is this one of those things, or is this just kind of the standard practice now under, new federal Medicaid guidelines?
WPR's politics team, Sean Johnson and Anya Van Wagtendonk, providing us context on last night's State of the State address from Governor Tony Evers in front of the legislature, in front of state Supreme Court justices, tribal leaders, other statewide officials. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your perspectives at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Governor Tony Evers delivers his sixth State of the State address from State Assembly Chambers, we get morning after analysis from WPR's politics team. We have State Capitol reporter Anya Van Wagtendonk and Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts as well. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So following Governor Evers' speech, we hear from Senate Majority Leader Devin LeMahieu, who delivered the Republican response. Here's part of his comments promoting tax cuts.
Wisconsin's priorities are fully funded, and yet the state still is projected to have a $4 billion surplus. That surplus should not be spent to further grow the size of government, as the governor suggests, rather create new entitlement programs or even sit in a bank account in Madison earning interest. The surplus should be returned to the working taxpayers who have given the state government more than their money than is necessary.
Okay, so Anya, there he is talking about returning those dollars, as you talked about before. Republicans have released a package of tax cut proposals. Who would benefit under these measures?
Yeah, so they actually announced them yesterday morning, so clearly kind of in conversation with the state of the state. It's a package of four bills that would raise the cap on the second tax bracket in the state to $150,000, up from $38,000. So that essentially amounts to a tax cut for those higher earners who would basically get bumped down a bracket. It would also expand the tax credit for childcare costs and on retirement income and raise the married couple tax credit. Estimates showed that it would amount to about it would cost about $2.1 billion for the next year and a half-ish, and then cost about $1.4 billion a year after that. And so it is, you know, sort of what we were talking about with that difference on funding childcare. There is this different philosophical approach to what to do with the surplus, whether to kind of put it into programs or, as Republicans say, to kind of give people's money back to them to spend how they see fit.
Sean, does a tax cut like this align with Governor Evers' values on what a tax cut should look like and who it should target?
I'm not certain yet. His office hasn't given a clear indication of where they're at on it. We've kind of gotten used to them saying no to the most recent round of tax cuts from Republicans. He has signed them in the past. He has promoted his own tax cuts in the past, but he's had a few vetoes lately. Republicans are saying that this tax cut that would bump up that second bracket to $150,000, they're saying, look, the governor's on the record with that number, calling that middle class. So we hope he'll sign this one. And he has said stuff in the past talking about $150,000 for families as a middle class tax cut. So I think we're going to have to wait and see on this one. You haven't heard a strong indication from the governor on it, though. And he did not talk about any of the governor's proposal, any of the Republicans' proposals in his speech last night.
He didn't talk about any of the Republican proposals in his speech last night, but offered some more sweeping comments about expanding paid family leave, funding for education at all levels. How does the governor plan to bring lawmakers together to advance policy on issues like this?
I think it's going to be tough for him this year. You know, he has called for this stuff in his budget last year, but we're on a 2-year budget cycle here in Wisconsin. So, you know, I know it's January and it feels like things are just getting started here, but for the legislature, this session is going to end soon. They're probably going to wrap up most of their business by late February, maybe early March. And, you know, so for the governor to get buy-in on a new child care plan or, you know, family leave or something like that, it's a challenge. It's the kind of thing where, like, you could imagine him potentially giving them something they want and them giving him something he wants as part of a deal, you know, tax cuts, child care, that type of thing. But we just haven't heard anything about that in the public. And time is running out here.
When you mentioned time, you can also talk about how Republicans even met last night after the State of State address to address election maps. Talk about what happened after the address, passing new maps last night after the address.
Yeah, they didn't pass them, but
they didn't pass.
They,
okay.
they floated the idea. So what happened yesterday is the Senate met, and we didn't really see that coming until a day ahead of time, and didn't really know what they were going to do until hours ahead of time. But Senate Republicans passed a new redistricting plan that they said was largely based on one that Governor Tony Evers submitted to the Supreme Court as part of this redistricting, lawsuit that's still ongoing, where the court may yet draw maps for the remainder of this decade. So Republicans passed this map, and Assembly Republicans, Speaker Voss, said last night, hey, we're going to look at it. We might pass it tonight. And in fact, they are coming back in this morning at 10, where they're expected to take up redistricting. And, you know, the talk is that they're trying to get something that Governor Tony Evers could sign, which would basically cut the Wisconsin Supreme Court out of this redistricting process. So you'd have new maps. And that, you know, if that theory holds, but the governor's office has said, hey, if it's not the map that the governor proposed, we are not under any obligation to sign it. Basically, we're not going to sign it if it's not his.
So something to seriously watch there, as so many different, it seems like we need a spreadsheet now on the maps, that proposals that are out there, because you got this, the state Supreme Court doing them, and then the legislature as well. You know, what should we be watching for, Sean, as this unfolds?
I think it would be great. You know, you've had some political scientists, John Johnson at Marquette, namely, do a breakdown of all these maps that were proposed to the Wisconsin Supreme Court as part of this lawsuit. Because right, the status right now is our court and the new liberal majority has said that the current legislative maps drawn by Republicans are unconstitutional. And the court has said, legislature, governor, it's up to you to pass new ones if you want. But if you don't, we are going to step in and choose new maps. And so this is kind of an 11th hour attempt by the legislature to step in and get something that they're okay with. But the governor's plan, like the others submitted by Democratic plaintiffs and, you know, others who are party to the case, would shrink Republican majorities in the legislature, which are huge right now for a purple state. I mean, you're looking at a near veto-proof majority in both chambers. So the governor's plan would be better for Democrats, but potentially not as good for Democrats as some options that are currently before the court. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. As we talk about the State of the State address, Sean Johnson with us, Anya Van Wagtendonk, both reporters covering the Capitol and unfolding politics. You can join in. Questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. The governor touted approving additional state aid for local government services as a significant accomplishment from last year.
Our bipartisan effort included a 20% increase in support to most municipalities statewide. After a generation of our state asking for local partners to do more with less, today we're working to deliver on our promise of making sure our communities can meet basic and unique needs alike.
And Sean, how much are communities benefiting from the additional state aid known as shared revenue?
I think that at this point, you've heard nothing but the good stuff. I mean, it's very early on in terms of how that aid is actually translating to, services being funded. But it was just passed last year. So all the communities that wanted it are saying good things. I mean, and Milwaukee was talking about dire consequences if that state aid package didn't also include a, sales tax for the city and county, which they got. So we're kind of in those early stages right now. But that was one of the biggest bills that, the governor will sign this session. And, kind of remarkable that they signed it at all, given the partisan breakdown of state government.
Anya, last words here in our moments together. How active are you expecting lawmakers to be in the next few weeks? How busy is your schedule?
Well, I am apparently returning to the Capitol at 10 a.m. today, so it does seem like things are going to be moving and churning. They're also due to meet Thursday, so there are quite a few things on the calendar. If this maps thing does get relatively resolved, that would at least take a little something off my calendar, but I'm expecting legislators to really be kind of putting in the hours up through the end of session. There are quite a few bills still left to be resolved. And so it is never a dull moment on the Capitol beat.
Well, thank you both for joining us and getting us up to speed.
Thanks for having
us. Thanks, Kate.
Anya Van Wagtendonk, WPR's state Capitol reporter. Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show. You're on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A Madison-based organization secures millions of dollars in federal funds to work with farmers on soil health and water quality issues. We explore the conservation work ahead. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Green Bay Packers fans have had a tough week coming out of a loss in the playoffs. And despite the crushed dreams following a surprising season, it's certain that most fans will stay loyal to the green and gold no matter what. WPR's Tyler Ditter has a story about that devotion.
Green Bay Packers fans are a proud community. It's not just the tailgating and freezing temperatures or the adrenaline rush of witnessing a Hail Mary, but fans love that their team is the only publicly owned NFL team. Mary Jane Herber and Molly Schrader talked about this as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Back in the early 90s, when they were talking about doing the referendum for the stadium to be expanded, and people would say to me, "You're not going to vote for that?" And I'd say, "Yes, I am." And they'd say, "Why?" And I picked out a community in the Midwest, state capital, same size. The people in that community, the businessmen in that community, would give anything to be able to say, "I'm from XYZ, and it's the home of the Packers." It opens a business door. Whether the Packers are playing well or poorly, there's still that door. Oh, Vince Lombardi. Oh, Brett Favre. Oh, Bart Starr. It opens that door for business because people know where Green Bay is.
And I think it's pretty cool, too, that, like, anyone can be an owner. I got my ownership certificate, what, like, a year ago?
Your stock certificate?
Yeah, my stock. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And I got it as a present, and I was like, look at me, I'm finally an owner. So I can, like, walk in, and I'm meeting people from across the country and be like, yep, I'm one of the owners of the Green Bay Packers. No big deal.
So am I. I'm an owner of the Green Bay Packers. I have one share.
Me too.
You know, I'm one share. And, you know, my family is so conservative in terms of, you know, we just don't spend money wildly. And my mother had the catalog for the pro shop on her kitchen table. And I said, "Where did you get this?" "I guess I probably got it because I bought a share of stock when it was for sale." This was back in the 90s. I said, "You bought a share? I bought a share. My brother bought a share. None of us told each other that we bought stock because we were all afraid that the other person was going to say to us, 'You what?' Because it doesn't pay any dividend. You can't sell it. You can only give it to a relative. It doesn't move you up on the season ticket list. It does nothing other than to make sure that the Green Bay Packers stay in Green Bay, Wisconsin." But that team would be gone if there had been a sole owner. It's the businessmen of this community in the 20s and the 30s and the 50s and the 60s that made sure, you know, and that executive committee of maybe 9 people on the committee, and then there's 40 people on the board as a whole. Lots of judges and women in business. When we had Antiques Roadshow here back in 2017, somebody was sitting at a table for lunch, and some of the executive producer and stuff for the Antiques Roadshow came over and sat down with them, and they got talking about Packer stock. And she said, "You don't get a dividend? No. You don't get moved up the list? No. I'm going to have to go back to Boston and have my husband explain this to me." Because it made no sense to her that people would plunk down $100. I think the last time it was $200 or $300 for a share. I don't know. I know it went up from the $100 my mother and I paid.
Yeah, I don't think it was $100.
No, I think it went up to two.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure. You know, people, what happened to the money? Well, they use it to work on the stadium and do things to keep things up to speed, and that it's one of the best places in the world to view sports. That's what they always say. You know, Roland Garros for the French Open. You know, there's other places that you want to be, and Lambeau Field is one of them.
That was Brown County librarians Mary Jane Herber and Molly Schrader. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about a multi-state approach to farming conservation through a nearly $14 million grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture seeking to improve water quality and soil health on farmlands in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heidi Peterson leads the Sand County Foundation's agricultural conservation team and sets the direction of the organization's strategic research. Heidi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here today.
The Sand County Foundation supports voluntary conservation by private landowners. Let's talk about that distinction. How receptive are farmers and ranchers to adopting the practices that you promote?
Well, I think you have to realize it's all about their livelihood. And most farmers and ranchers across the nation, you know, they're thinking about how they can preserve their land for the next generation. And so most of the hesitation to adopt a new practice comes from the unknowns. And that's what we're all about at Sand County Foundation, is setting up demonstrations so that we can break down the barriers to adoption and let farmers feel more comfortable with trying something new on their land and seeing how they will be able to benefit both through the environmental benefits and also their productivity.
And farmers have been trying new things on their land since 2016, when the Wisconsin Producer-Led Watershed Protection Grant Program started. The number of watershed groups that received the grant nearly tripled. Why is coordinating efforts at the watershed level particularly helpful?
One of the reasons we really enjoy working at the watershed level, specifically with these watershed groups, is that you're able to understand the direct benefit to your region. When you're working in a watershed, you see the resources that you're affecting. And so it puts it into perspective. And everybody wants clean water. Everybody wants to be able to enjoy the opportunity to take their children or grandchildren out to the lake to swim, or to have access to clean drinking water. So this is part of why working at the watershed level is really important and impactful.
And farmers having to band together, right? They create groups in the watersheds. They have to really work shoulder to shoulder. I wonder, what is the significance of farmers needing to work together to unlock grants?
So right now in Wisconsin, the DATCAP, the Department of Ag's producer-led groups, they have moved forward to launch 47 supported watershed groups, and these are specifically the farmers, and that are coming together. And the benefit of working together as a group is that they're learning from each other. It's a peer-to-peer network. They can have maybe an expert within their community that has really understood how to implement cover crops, or what timing, you know, when should we get out there and plant, or at what stage should the crops go in. And this is an opportunity to learn from each other and have that support network. So when you come together and you have within the producer-led groups of Wisconsin to form an official group, you need at least 5 collaborating farmers. When you get those 5 farmers together, and you put your heads together to figure out what are the issues we want to address and how can we put incentives together to get more farmers within our watershed on board. It's really successful, and it really builds that network of trust. Hmm.
You mentioned cover crops. What projects are these grants being spent on? What is the money going toward?
So cover crops in particular is one of the hot topics, I would mm-hmm. say, amongst the watershed groups. And it's looking at some of the cost share around the seed costs. So it is an investment by the farmer to purchase that seed. And so each group gets to identify what they want their grant to go toward. Sometimes it's speakers, sometimes it's the incentive for the seed purchase. But I think by having that opportunity to just try something new and, get your foot in the door, it doesn't have to be the entire farm. It could be an acre to begin with and just see how it works. That's how you get started. It's baby steps, and cover crops is a great way to try it.
And meanwhile, the Sand County Foundation is awarded nearly $14 million in federal grants intended to start farmer-driven watershed groups regionally, Illinois, expanding them in Iowa and Wisconsin. What lessons can our Wisconsin neighbors learn from Wisconsin's conservation efforts and vice versa?
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely is an opportunity to scale up conservation adaption, because when you are working together as a peer network and you have the resources for technical assistance, that is how you're going to engage more of the late adopters. There are a lot of farmers that are already using reduced tillage, cover crops. And so we've seen that through Wisconsin's program, which, again, this is the first state and only state in the nation that has a program like this. And so if we can show other states that it's an important investment, and again, it's an investment by the state government to fund these watershed groups, it's how you're going to move the needle toward achieving these environmental goals, especially with water quality and addressing the the Mississippi River Basin targets. And so if we can get some of the groups started in Illinois and Iowa and show the interest by the farmers and the enthusiasm to learn from each other, that's what's going to make the difference and to allow these programs to continue to have the success and the support needed.
And water quality, watershed, soil health, they know no state boundaries, right? Just because there is a state boundary line, you can still, those watersheds continue regardless.
Exactly. And then you think about the benefits downstream. And that's what is really, really exciting when we look at the changes that we can address at the private level with these farmers and on the farmland. The benefits that we will end up seeing downstream is reduced flooding, again, improvement in water quality. We're going to see the habitat for, pollinators and wildlife starting to flourish. And so this is definitely a community effort. It's all hands on deck. And it's amazing that Wisconsin was the leader, to initiate a program like this.
Heidi Peterson is Vice President of Agricultural Research and Conservation at Sand County Foundation. That's a nonprofit environmental conservation organization based in Madison. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore Sand County Foundation's new efforts to improve water and soil quality as part of farmer-led conservation initiatives in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa. The nearly $14 million grant is through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and Heidi Peterson leads the Sand County Foundation's agricultural conservation team. Be part of the conversation. You can call in with a question. Share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Heidi, let's address compliance issues. The foundation emphasizing it supports voluntary conservation by farmers and ranchers. What is the organization's position on conservation compliance or federal mandates that tie commodity and crop insurance subsidies to soil and wetland and grassland conservation?
From my experience working directly on the land with farmers, we are seeing that there are a lot of farmers who want to care for their land and live out their land ethic, even without the need for, the federal cost share programs. They definitely make a difference to, support the costs of the conservation practices. But the farmers are motivated to do practices, implement change on their land so that they continue to have, the productivity that they need to be able to run their business. Farmers can't be green if they're in the red. And so making sure that the conservation strategies that they implement have that economic sense is important. And so the programs like crop insurance, they're there to support the unknowns. Mother Nature doesn't have a guidebook that the farmers can go from to understand what's going to happen tomorrow. And so every detail of farming and managing that land is at the mercy of Mother Nature in terms of when it's going to rain and how much it's going to rain. And so we're at a critical point in time where we're having more extreme rainfall events and they're happening more frequently. And so the farmers are having to make quick decisions to understand how to manage their land. And so having the programs like the crop insurance, it's to help when we're at this critical time of climate shifting and the extreme rainfall.
And certainly too, as farmers address their land, they have to also decide whether even to sell it or to keep it in, right, in production. And the ability to keep it in production versus the attraction of selling it off to developers. Is that a difficult issue?
I think it's one that many farmers are faced with. They want to be able to keep the land in production for the next generation. And if there isn't a next generation, within their own family, there's been a lot of interest in passing the land along to other beginning farmers. Our demographics of farming is changing, and being able to provide access to land and affordable land is a really important topic for discussion. I know it's a challenge to see how do we continue to make a return on our investment at the farm scale.
We're talking about future steps in watershed conservation in Wisconsin and beyond. Heidi Peterson of the Sand County Foundation is our guide. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Heidi, last week one of our callers expressed concern about solar farms taking up large tracts of land out of production as farmland, and specifically in Washara County. And I understand you're in contact with landowners in that area wanting to raise crops and graze livestock under solar panels. Does solar power fit with the conservation mission of your foundation?
What we have been working on recently is a program around agrivoltaics. And so there are opportunities when you want to continue to farm, but you're looking for an additional income and you bring solar panels onto your farm, you can still manage that land and think about conservation. And so being able to either implement pollinator habitat underneath the solar panels, you can graze sheep or chickens underneath those solar panels. And so there's a way to find a balance. And that's what we want to do as an organization, is see what that balance is and understand how we can manage the land so that, you know, as we see more adoption of the solar panels and solar power across the nation, how can we do it in a way that's creating an opportunity for farmers to continue to utilize that land in a sustainable way.
In our last moments together, how do watershed groups quantify the effectiveness of their efforts to improve water quality and to improve soil health?
That's a great question, Kate. So what we have been doing to assist the farmer-led groups is, and we'll do some modeling. So there are tools available to farmers to actually inform the decisions that they're making, because it can be a difficult decision, especially because it's including their livelihood, you know, as they're implementing these changes. And so if we can put into a model and look at, all right, if we implement cover crops across your land, here's the environmental benefit. And we'll look at, you know, the nutrients that are coming off the land, the soil erosion that's happening. What is the benefit by implementing this practice? Or maybe we want to try a prairie strip, and we put a prairie strip in and we model that.
So you're running different scenarios to help make these really key decisions about saving the watersheds. Heidi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
Heidi Peterson is Vice President of Agricultural Research and Conservation at Sand County Foundation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Snowboarder Nick Baumgartner of Iron River, Michigan, grew up miles from the Wisconsin border, and he's schooled in the roller coaster of emotions as a four-time Olympian, coming up short of the podium and then winning gold in mixed snowboard cross at the Beijing Olympic Games in 2022. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, A Humble Beginning, Olympic Dreams, and the Power in Getting Back Up. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
You dedicate the book to all the youpers and talk about being filled with youper grit when times get tough. What does it mean to be from the Upper Peninsula, the UP?
Well, it's an area that I cherish. I mean, it's we call it paradise, but it's just an amazing place, and people work a lot harder from there. We think, and I think that comes from just having to fight for all the opportunities. We have less opportunities than the big city kids do, and it just takes a little bit more. No one's going to give us an opportunity. We have to fight for that, and we have to work for that. But I think that makes us stronger in the long run, and it sets us up for success.
Is that why you call yourself a blue-collar Olympian? Can you explain that distinction?
So blue-collar Olympian is it goes back to, like, I had to fund this dream. I didn't come from a background that allowed me to have the funds to go out and go to academies and go to these training facilities to do this. I had to find a more creative way to do it. And my goal was always to be a professional snowboarder. And the definition of a professional snowboarder is someone who gets paid to snowboard. So I had to be a little more creative. I found a job in Wisconsin as a union concrete laborer. And that allowed me to work long hours all summer long, making tons, very good money for a young kid. And then when the winter months came and it got too cold to pour concrete, we were laid off and then we could draw unemployment. So with a little creativity, I was able to get paid to snowboard. And it just, it made it better for me. It's my favorite part because I had to fight for it. If I didn't find a job and find a trade that allowed me to do this, it wouldn't have been possible for me.
You also have had to find sponsors along the way and for people to help fund you as well. And you have said that it feels like you have to really be a little bit of a sales pitch. Can you talk about that aspect of sponsorships and what it involves?
Yeah, you definitely have to be turned into a salesperson. And throughout my whole career, I've had to find creative ways to do that in the sense that snowboard cross, what we do, doesn't get a lot of support from the industry of snowboarding. So I had to find ways to find support outside of the industry. So for me, being from the Upper Peninsula, one of my number one sponsors is Ponzi, and they're a Finnish logging company with their North American headquarters in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And it's just because the number one industry where I live is logging. So I found someone that shared that same kind of stuff and that passion. And a lot of my friends and a lot of the people that I went to school with went on to start their own forestry and logging companies. And so that's how I was able to gain a relationship with these people. And they're just super passionate about being able to help me with what I'm doing. And they want to give me an opportunity. And it's been incredible. And I have another company, which is a hometown company, Crist Oil. They have gas stations throughout all of northern Wisconsin. And it's just finding people that that kind of share my same story and want to help and want to be a part of my legacy. And it's just finding that creativity and not being afraid to ask people. I think sometimes people are afraid to go out there and ask for things. And I've found that by asking people for stuff, I've gotten to do some pretty amazing things throughout my career. Things like racing trucks professionally all over the country, racing professionally in Mexico's Baja Peninsula. Gotten to do some cool things because I wasn't afraid to ask and to reach out to people.
We're talking with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, your son Landon, born when you were 22, and you dedicate the book as well to him. Can you describe, does Landon travel with you now that he's older? How do you incorporate family into your dream?
Yeah, well, I think my dream doesn't happen at all without the birth of my son. I was 22 years old. I was a child myself, and I was immature. I didn't know what the world was about. Mm-hmm. And I was more focused about me and what I wanted and what I needed. And I think by having a son and making it bigger than myself, I needed to not only provide for this kid at this point, but I needed to lead by example and show him what's possible. If you're willing to dream big and you're willing to outwork everybody. And without that, I don't know that I would have the longevity. I think I would have went into this with just the wrong attitude and it wouldn't have worked out. So by having my son, it's been unbelievable. I haven't been able to travel with him a bunch to a lot of races, but my first race he got to come to was in 2011. He got to come out to the X Games. And I found out very fast that when he's on the bottom of the hill, I race way better. And I actually, right before he showed up, it was 12 days before the X Games, I was training in Copper Mountain, Colorado, and I crashed and I broke my collarbone. Mm. I had to get 15 screws and a plate put in 12 days before the race. And everyone counted me out and thought that, all right, there's no way this guy's going to be a threat. But they didn't know that my son was going to be at the bottom. And I went on and to win 12 days after surgery, to win the biggest race of my life at that point. And it all had to do with having my son at the bottom, and just no one was going to beat me to the bottom to my son. There's no chance.
There's so much grit in your story, and it makes me wonder about those young years growing up with three older brothers and how, you know, everything was a competition. How did the competitiveness between you and your siblings motivate you early on and then kind of touch you throughout your career?
Well, I think my brothers were extreme athletes in everything they did. They were so good and so successful that they set the bar so high on how to get that success by outworking people and by fighting for what you wanted. And it showed me how to act. But more importantly, I wanted to beat my older brothers in something at some point. They were so good. And when you fast forward to high school, their senior year of high school got the most athletic in their class, as well as the best defensive player on the football team. I didn't get either of those things. So it kind of put a chip on my shoulder, and it made me work harder and fight for something. I wanted to prove that I was better than them at something. And I think it took till I was 40, coming home with a gold medal in snowboarding, to prove that I was the best snowboarder in the family. So I finally accomplished that goal after many years of trying.
Your parents also had three strict rules for the kids to follow growing up. One was that chores were mandatory. What else did they really, you know, passionately instill in you in terms of rules of the house?
Well, definitely you had to work. It was funny. Anytime a family member, a friend of the family, or one of my parents' relatives needed help, whether it be tilling a field for the farm and picking rocks or baling hay, they were always like, "Oh man, you guys need help. I got kids. We'll send them over."
And
we were never expected to get paid either. It was just to do the right thing, to help out our neighbors when they needed help. And it just instilled in us just that sense of helping out when we can, and that work ethic. And it's just, I'm very fortunate. We didn't grow up with a ton of money growing up, but we were rich in so many other aspects. My parents were foster care providers. My sister, we adopted when she was two and I was three, and just having all these kids in and out, just the lessons that we learned throughout all that. And my parents, man, I couldn't have grown up or asked for better parents than I had. And it's a big part of my success. Just the way that they raised us and the way that they showed us that, like I said, chores were necessary. And if you weren't doing a sport, you had to get a job. So we were always fighting to get into the next sport for the next sport. And to me, that's very important because, yes, you learn a lot in the classroom, but the lessons that I learned on the athletic field or on the wrestling mat, those lessons have helped me be successful in every aspect of my life. It teaches you about how to overcome adversity, how to deal with failure, and how to get back up when you get knocked down. And I think that's why you'll see so many lessons like that throughout my book. And every time I get knocked down, I get back up. And it was from those lessons that I learned in sport and through my family.
Nick Baumgartner is a snowboarding Olympic gold medalist. We explore his new memoir. It's called Gold from Iron. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn life lessons and how to chase a dream from a veteran Olympian snowboarder who proudly hails from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, minutes from the Wisconsin border. Nick Baumgartner's new memoir is called Gold from Iron, and you can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick, we heard from Jack and Madison called in, and Jack says it's great for a blue-collar Midwesterner to make it in sports, and reminds Jack of the Milwaukee Bucks winning the NBA championships in 2021. What advice do you have for Midwesterners or anyone from that background, Jack wonders, who are aspiring for sports greatness?
I think don't believe the excuses. I mean, we can always come up in even in our own heads of excuses of why we don't have the opportunity to do this. One, we don't come from the right place. One, we're too old, or we don't have the funds to be able to make this happen. There's always a way. There's always a way. If you dig in hard enough and you're willing to outwork people, there's always a way to make it happen. And we get one chance at life. I mean, why not fight for it? If you do everything you can, I mean, if you do everything you can that's possible to get what you want and you fall short, it's okay. You can live with that. You've done everything you can. There's no shame in that. But when you cut corners and you believe the excuses and you don't go out there and fight for what you want and then you fall short, that'll haunt you for the rest of your life. So go out there and get what you want out of life.
You also recommend putting pen to paper and writing down your goals. Why do you suggest that?
Well, I mean, I've read books and I've seen lessons and I've listened to speakers, and they always say writing down your goals is so important, because just by writing it down and looking at it over and over again, you're 40% more likely to achieve that goal. There's nothing in life that will give you a free 40% that easily. Just by writing it down, you 40% more likely to succeed. Come on. I mean, that's so easy to just write it down, look at it, put it on your refrigerator, put it in your bathroom, put it places where you will see this. And you got a way better chance for sure.
Okay. So we're going to talk about a coach at Copper Mountain in Utah who really helped you make a change that catapulted your career. Can you explain how one coach helped you so much?
Yeah. So when I got into snowboarding, I'm from basically northern Wisconsin, but right across the border in the Upper Peninsula. And there was no like blueprint on how to do this. I didn't know any professional snowboarders from the area. I didn't know any mentors that I could ask and figure out how to do this. I kind of just ran into it like, here I am. I don't know what I'm doing, but here I am. And that was good. And it was great because I took a chance, but I did need some knowledge and I needed some coaching. And I had a coach, Nate Park. He definitely, he found a way to break it down to me and explain to me the things that I was doing wrong, or why these movements or these different things that I needed to learn, why I needed to learn them. And just by having it broke down and having someone really explain it to me so that in a manner that I could understand it, it was like a light bulb went off and I was like, oh, well, that's why I need to do that. And once I understood and once I figured out like what the reason was, and it changed everything. Then I was willing to work harder for it. I was willing to do the right thing rather than just going out there and just doing something. I mean, that's a great way to start, to just go in there, but you got to learn how to figure it out. And surrounding yourself with people that know what's going on and how to do it is the best way to get that success faster.
It sounds like you also soak in information, especially about technique and other things. You just soak it in almost in an extremely active way. How do you acquire knowledge and then apply it as a snowboarder?
Well, for me, my biggest thing when I got into it, I had all the drive in the world and the passion. I wanted to win it. And I think that's like something, sometimes you can't coach that. But when you can find someone that has that, you can teach them everything else. So for me, I wanted it so bad. And I, at first, before I had my coach, I didn't know like what to do. So what I did is I picked out the guys that were the best. That had already figured it out and knew what they were doing. And then I tried to emulate them. I was like, if I just do what they're doing, I'm going to get better. When I tried to do a turn, I wanted to look like a kid that ended up being my teammate for many years, Graham Watanabe, a three-time Olympian. I was like, this guy has the best form I've ever seen. If I can just try, to look like that when I'm riding, it's going to be better. And I started to pick things up. And just by looking at the people that had already figured it out, asking questions, it's so important to find people that know how to do it and ask questions. But when you ask questions to people that really know what's going on, man, it short tracks everything and it gets you a little shortcut to the top. Obviously, there is no shortcuts. I shouldn't say shortcut because it's a bad word to use. There is no shortcuts. Hard work is always the answer. But by talking to people, you don't waste that energy. You're more efficient with what you're doing.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner in conversation about his new memoir, Gold from Iron. You can join in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Nick, you meet who you call Mr. Swixguy and learn about waxing your boards. And I'm wondering first, you know, how many boards do you carry with you around the world?
When I travel now, so at this race, I have seven snowboards with me.
Seven race boards,
and then one free ride board. So when we're not on course and we're just having fun, because it's important for us to not just always do the sport and the training, and that you need to keep the love for it. So I make sure that I have a board that's fun to ride and just out there and having fun. But we have different boards for different conditions, different grinds on the base of our boards. That's a structure that they put on the bottom for different conditions. So yeah, we travel with a lot of boards and it does get difficult. But going back to what you said, the Swixguy. Yeah, I showed up to a race again at the beginning. I just showed up not knowing what I was doing. And I showed up to this big race. It was my first televised race in Crested Butte, Colorado. And I see all these guys like rubbing stuff on their boards and doing all these things to the bottom of their board. And I was like, oh, crap. I have no idea what they're doing. And that looks very important. And luckily there was a guy from the company Swix that was, he was selling and pushing this paste that he had that they would put on the bottom. So I went up to him again to give myself a chance. And I asked him questions. I was like, hey man, what do you got there? And can I use some of that? And luckily he had these samples that he was giving people and he handed me some, and then he told me what to do. So I start working on my board, and then I get in the heat. And it's funny because all the people that were there, they're like, dude, you're in big trouble. You're racing against one, that guy right there won last year. That guy won the year before, and that guy next to him is his brother. So you're in big trouble. And I was like, oh, all right, well, here we go. I'm going to go do my best. And luckily the Swix guy gave me that sample stuff. And I went out there and I won that first heat. And when I got back to the top, he grabbed my board and he said, you are not touching this thing anymore. And then he went and started putting the stuff on that all these guys were putting on, the better stuff. And it just leveled the playing field. And it gave me an opportunity to be successful. Because without that, there's no chance that I would have been able to. My skill and my ability and my determination would not have been enough. I needed to have the same chance as everyone else. And luckily, this guy was willing to do it.
One other thing that has really taken snowboarding to the next level is technology and like drones looking at courses and what lines to follow. What new things are going on there?
So for us, we've always had this like technical advantage. We had a coach for many years that was just like a super nerd about this kind of stuff, about giving us that technical advantage. He actually invented a video system that allowed us as a team and no other team. I think the teams are slowly starting to get this now, but we've already had it for 15 years, where he would film from up on the edge of the mountain way up high so he could get the entire course. And as he's filming, as soon as he gets done, it goes through this Wi-Fi system. He sets up what looks like a little weather station, and the other teams are looking at him like he's crazy. Like, what's that weather system? It was just a Wi-Fi system that would allow him to shoot that video from his camera, bounce it off of the Wi-Fi system, and throw it to iPads that were at the top of the course.
So you can exactly see what your teammates and other racers are doing. Talking about a new memoir from Nick Baumgartner on being an Olympian, what it's like. You can call in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Olympic snowboarding gold medalist Nick Baumgartner pushes the limits on top of mountains. The Michigan native's new memoir, Gold from Iron, recounts his journey to four Olympics and the community in the Upper Peninsula who rally around him. You can join the conversation, call in with a question, share your views at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Jean in Wales. Jean, hi, go ahead.
Hi. Hey, Nick, we're so proud of you. I'm a Youper from the UP, been there forever, and have followed your journey from the very, very beginning. So I'm on my sixth copy of your book that my family all wanted.
Oh, Jean, thank you so much for calling in. Nick, you can feel the warmth from Jean and so many others. You know, when you come back or came back from the Olympics, you had a huge parade that escorted you. You know, how was that parade and how was that reception?
It was unbelievable. So I landed into Green Bay, Wisconsin. I walked out and I just hear chants of USA, USA, the Olympic music playing in the background. And I walked out to just so many friends of mine that are from the Green Bay area. And then my son surprised me. So I got to see him, hug, lots of tears, lots of high fives, and then we stayed the night there so that I could come into town the next day. And my favorite thing was being able to drive through these community. I think Pembine, Wisconsin was the first one that had people spread out throughout the town. And then Niagara, and then we crossed into Michigan, and then through Iron Mountain back into Florence, Wisconsin, and all the way home. And just seeing so many people willing to stand out in the freezing cold and cheering for us. But being able to have my son there made it so special. And just to, I mean, there was a lot of tears happening. And then when we got to Iron River, it was crazy. There was people from all over the Midwest that had driven up to be a part of that parade. And rather than drive through the town, I decided to get out and walk and be able to walk over and hug people. And anytime I saw someone that even had a little bit to do with my journey, the tears would start flowing and the hugs would happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why, I mean, it's someone like Jean that makes me so proud to represent these people. It's just amazing people that when you do something good and you're from a small community, everyone will rally behind you. And it's been the story of my journey for sure.
Let's pick up on the tears, because you gave dozens of speeches after winning the gold at age 40, and you shed tears in front of your audiences. I'm wondering how you deal with emotions and the raw emotions you feel, whether it's right after a race in front of news cameras or in front of your audiences in the UP.
It's just one thing I can say is ever since I represented not only my country, my family, but my whole community back in the Midwest at the first Olympics in 2010, when I walked out into opening ceremonies, it changed me as a human being. I went from thinking I was this young, tough guy to a very emotional. And now if I go and watch like kids' sporting events and I see like whatever age it is, maybe even an 8-year-old make a basket, everyone's cheering and having a good time. And I'm in the corner crying. And it's brought out those emotions in me. And I think it's very important. Emotions are good. And to be able to share them as this masculine athlete is, I think it's important for people to see that. And it's not like a trick or anything. I just, when I start talking about my story and the things I've gotten to do and fighting through those challenges to get to that point where I finally won that medal, the tears just come out naturally. And I'm happy to share it. I'm not embarrassed by it in any way, shape or form. I think it's important. Yeah, sometimes I can't finish my sentences, which makes it a little tough to do a speech, but it's awesome. And I think it's that raw and that honest emotion that people want to see and people should see.
I want to explore how you found the Upper Peninsula a really perfect training ground for an Olympian, you know, physically and mentally. You know, you write about how Dustin Brancio popped into your life. Can you talk about that training and what you did in the UP?
Like I mentioned before, the Upper Peninsula, we don't have the same opportunities as everyone else. You go to these big cities, and they have these sports specific training facilities with just the top of the line, the technology, everything is there for you to be successful, and we don't have that all over the Upper Peninsula. And to be honest, the only place I could find that was in Marquette, Michigan. And I was very fortunate that Dustin Branchow at Advantage Sports Training in Marquette reached out to me and he said, "Hey, I think we can help you with your training." And I was like, "All right, here's a guy, a fellow Youper that really wants to be a part of this." And not only that, but he was a football player. He's a collegiate football player who was trying to make it to the NFL. And that was my first dream. I went to college to play football. Unfortunately, found out that I was too immature for college and I needed to take a break. And that's when I switched to the snowboarding. But this guy understood me and he got me. And by going up there and training with him, at 40 years old, you can't just do the same old stuff you were doing. You got to be more efficient in what you're doing. So with his program, I was able to be efficient. And if, say, I showed up and I was tired, we had technology and we had eyes and computers reading the speed at which I was pushing the weights. So if I was tired and exhausted, I just didn't do it because I needed to do another set. We knew when, all right, you're tired, you need to take a break. We need to change this and do something different. And that was the first time that I experienced that when I was back home in the UP. And it was, I think it was crucial to my success at the Olympics.
Meanwhile, living out of your van with your dog Oakley, why did you decide to do that?
So, I mean, when we say a blue collar Olympian, I needed to find a way to not have to pour concrete all summer long because one, I needed to be able to train more. And when you're working 12-hour days, it's hard to fit it in. And then I'm beating the crap out of my body, my hands, my back. I was just hurting myself. So I needed to find a way. So my brother's a contractor out in Aspen, Colorado. So I went out there and I worked for him for a month in the spring. And that made me enough money to not have to work all summer long. And, but I didn't have money to go up to Marquette and spend $200 a night staying in a hotel. So I had this van that I used for construction and I just slid a bed into the back and we parked it anywhere we could find a place to do it because I saved so much money being able to do that. By staying in the van, I wasn't spending $600 to $800 a week in hotel rooms. I was just spending the gas money going up and it just made it so much more feasible. And then I would go straight from the gym to the mountain bike trails. And I think people don't understand that. I mean, I've been all over the world and I've mountain biked at a lot of places. And the mountain bike trails that we have in the Upper Peninsula are world class. And it was important for me because mountain biking is the closest thing I can get to what I do on sport. So it's the best cross training I can do. And by going up and staying the night in Marquette and working out 4 days a week, it gave me that opportunity to just set myself up for the closest training and the closest replication to what I do on the snow.
I smiled when you jump into Lake Superior at the end of a hard day working out.
Right. I mean, Lake Superior is freezing cold and people talk about, oh, it's so cold. How do you go swimming? But Lake Superior will heal you if you jump into that cold water. And it's very important. And I think now you see so many people starting to do these cold plunges. Well, that's the biggest cold plunge in the world.
Team USA snowboarder Nick Baumgartner, our guide to the Olympics, What It Takes, new memoir, Gold from Iron. And you can join in with questions, 800-642-1234. Okay, Nick, truck racing, what the heck got into you? What was this period where you went into truck racing?
So it's funny, I started racing snowboards because of people like Sean Palmer and seeing these other athletes, these extreme athletes doing these amazing things. And for me, lots of people would say, oh, these guys are lucky. They're on TV. They get to do this cool stuff like Travis Pastrana, Brian Deegan, all these guys. And it was just funny. A lot of them, they made their name in one sport. And then they use that fame to cross over into rally racing. So when I got started into snowboarding, the goal was always to make a name for myself and cross over into auto sports. Well, fortunately, one of the biggest off-road truck racing place tracks in the world is in Crandon, Wisconsin. And I had a friend who started racing trucks and asked me to come there and to be the voice in his ear, telling him what was going on around him. And it got me one step closer to that seat, that driver's seat. And I was like, I need to do this. And again, I just went out and I started asking people, and I asked people, and to my surprise, I started getting yeses. And I was able to race pro lights in the, I can't remember what it is now, but it's the Traxxas Torque Series when I was doing it. And I got to race against these guys that paved the way for me and gave me the blueprint, like Brian Deegan, Travis Pastrana. And I got to go out there and do that. And for me, it was a way for me to live on that edge, because when I'm racing snowboards, if it's crazy and things are happening around me, you got to be comfortable in the uncomfortable. And being able to stay at that, bouncing off that rev limiter and just going full speed all the time, I thought that it was going to give me this big advantage. So it was important for me to be able to do that. Plus, it was fun. It was like the craziest thing you've ever done, just pushing on that gas pedal and going as hard as you can. But it allowed me to race all year round, keeping those skills in that, all those skills just sharp and ready to go. So when I got back, all my competitors hadn't raced since the last season. Well, I've been racing all summer, so let's go. I'm ready.
And you had a major rollover, and just the dangers of that sport. Did that at all impact your snowboarding?
No, and I think you learn that, like, when I crash on a snowboard, you get hurt. I broke my back. I broke my collarbone. Mm. I've had some injuries along the way. But in a race truck, you have this thing that's engineered and designed to keep you safe. Yes, accidents can happen and you can get injured. But I've rolled over in trucks. Like, we rolled over in Mexico in the Baja Peninsula. Mm-hmm. I was a passenger at this point. At 80 miles an hour, I rolled 5 times off the freeway. And when we came to a rest, I was like, I'm fine. This is crazy. It was hard to believe. But there's a saying that they say, with age comes the cage. Because you can't take those hits as much. And when I'm on a snowboard, I've found a way to be a little bit better at calculating my risks and not just taking risks just to take them. So I don't crash as much as I used to. But in a race truck, I had all this stuff to protect me. But it was so fun. It was like the coolest thing I've ever gotten to do. And I think when people read this book, they're going to be blown away with the things that I got to do just because I wasn't afraid to ask.
Nick Baumgartner, Olympic gold medalist in snowboarding from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan near the Wisconsin border. New memoir tracing this journey of learning to snowboard as a teenager and then setting his sights on the Olympics, getting there multiple times. Call in with a question. Add your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Olympic snowboarder Nick Baumgartner about his new memoir, tracing his journey from a small community in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan to top the podium at the Beijing Olympic Games. And there's space to talk. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Susie in Hartford is here. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Kate. I love your show. Nick, it's been so fun to watch your journey. I can't wait to read your book. All I can say is Niner would be so proud of all the things you're keeping doing. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Nick, that must feel so good to you. Can you talk about where your journey goes from here?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been very fortunate to have such a long career, but I've always said, as long as I'm having fun and I'm competitive, which kind of go hand in hand, I'm going to continue to do this as long as I can. And now everyone's like, well, why didn't you quit when you were on top? And I was like, well, now there's no pressure. I have the medal. So now I can just have fun and that pressure goes away. And I think when you're just having fun and there's no pressure, you become very dangerous. And even at 44 years old, I think that I have an opportunity to show up. Yes, I'm not going to be super fast at every single track, but when that track suits me and the things line up in my favor, you better watch out. Do not count me out, because I'm coming for you. And the fact that I'm still fast and I'm still having fun, it's just, for me, it's like I got plenty of time to get old and to not be able to do this. So if there's even a chance that I can continue to do this, I'm going to do it. And that journey is going to head towards the 2026 Winter Olympics in Milano Cortina. My mom's family is all from a small village in northern Italy, and they really want me to be able to, or want to be able to go there. And so I guess there is a little bit of pressure. All my aunts and uncles and my cousins are like, we want to go, so you got to go. And I'm just having fun, and that's what life's about, having as much fun as you can. And like I said, I've been very fortunate to be able to do this, and I'm just going to keep doing it, because not only is it fun, but it still gives me those dreams and those goals, to set goals and to keep fighting for it and to push my body to see what I'm capable of.
And you're the veteran snowboarder out there. You've seen it all. You've seen so much. And the young snowboarders, they're watching you and looking up to you as that role model for the sport. You know, what do you want the sport to achieve next? Where do you see snowboarding going, and what can you do to propel it there?
Well, my biggest thing that I love about being the veteran and the mentor to these younger kids is, it's funny, for the U.S. snowboard team, I think it's very important to have a guy like me on the team, because one, like, these younger kids are coming to steal my job. So I work so hard and I make so many sacrifices, because the last thing I want to do is show up and look old. And I think a lot of people, as we're aging, can understand where I'm coming from. But on the other side of that, these kids are seeing that I'm pushing that and I'm staying fast. So they're out there pushing themselves and putting in the work, maybe more than they would have with not, because they don't want to lose to somebody that's as old as their parents. That's like not supposed to happen. So if they do, it just, they push me, but then in return, I push them so much harder. And I think it's bringing one, our team, to another level. But I think it crosses across to everybody. No one wants to lose to an older guy, especially someone that's the same age as their parents. So we push this level, and snowboarding is such an amazing sport to me. Some people, we get a bad name, we get a bad rap. People think we're the troublemakers, we're I don't know, the rebels. But we found this sport and we wanted to do it because it's cool, because it's our own thing. And to see how far it's come, every time I look at freestyle snowboarding, the half pipe, slope style, I think, like, it can't get any bigger than this. And now people are doing three flips and a half pipe and landing. And every time I think that, can we push this further? We find a way to push it further and to see what's possible. And it's just so cool to watch it, but it's even cooler to have been a part of it for so many years and to push this sport to the levels that it's at.
Another veteran in Lindsay Giacobellis, you winning the gold in 2022 with her, and you write about that friendship, like, she's your sister. How did it feel to win that gold together?
Yeah, having a teammate makes it, I think, a lot more special. I would have loved to win the individual one, but I made a mistake and I had to own that. But when you bring a teammate into the thing, and especially for me being partnered with Lindsay, who is the greatest female snowboard cross racer of all time, it takes a little bit of pressure off, because I'm pushing as hard as I can because I don't want to let her down. But if I do make a mistake, I've got the GOAT to make up for it. So it just, it allows some of that pressure to come off, but it also makes it more special because we're doing this together. She's giving everything she have to make sure that I'm successful, and I'm doing everything I can to make sure that she's successful. So it brings our level of riding to another level. And it's so special to be able to do it together. And for, for her to be 36 years old and for me to be 40 and to beat the bronze medal went to a 20 and a 22 year old. I mean, that, come on, a 42 year old to a 76 year old combined age. It's crazy. And it just, it was super special. And I think we made a statement at that Olympics.
I want to land on the danger because you discuss snowboarding tracks that you felt were too dangerous for people to ride, especially at Sochi. Why are people allowed to compete on such dangerous tracks?
I think it goes back to just people need to trust the people that are actually risking their lives. We're out there doing everything we can to one, to put on a show, but to push ourselves to be successful in what we're doing. But if we say it's not safe, you need to believe us and you need to put in the work to make sure that it's safe. Like we don't want it like super safe. We understand the risk going in. That's what makes our sport so cool. So we don't want it to be easy and have no risk, but we don't want any just ignorant, unsafe things. Like we want it to be like, I love jumping at the X Games. When I won, we were jumping 130 feet. At 60 miles an hour, which is crazy to most people, but we train for that. And we know that risk when we go in. But it's when we see a problem with a course and they don't listen to us that makes it frustrating. And we've found ways since then. It's like anything. Mistakes were made. But we've learned from those mistakes, and now they find ways to listen to us better, to have a communication with the athletes, to the builders, to the coaches, to the organizers. And unfortunately, some lessons need to be learned the hard way. And I think that goes back to my book. Like, I'm so proud of this book and the fact that there's so many young athletes out there that, yes, when you learn things the hard way, it sticks better and you learn it and it really sticks, but you shouldn't have to learn everything the hard way. Some of us have already done that for you. And so you can read about it and learn and go, okay, all right, he did this and he learned from it. Maybe I don't have to do that.
Oh, Nick, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your journey.
Well, I appreciate it, you guys. And I know I always talk about being so proud and being from the Upper Peninsula, but I live 7 miles from the Wisconsin border.
You have the Wisconsin love as well. Yes. Nick Baumgartner, new memoir, Gold from Iron. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.